This is special programming from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. It's been 15 weeks since the campfire started. Tonight on After Paradise, we hear from Chico Mayor Randall Stone about the major housing shortage in the city of Chico. We learn why a new law enacted to help fire survivors with insurance coverage will not help those displaced by the campfire. And we hear from the Paradise Ridge Chamber of Commerce about the work going into bringing a vibrant business community back to Paradise. Again, we would not be able to do this program without your questions to drive our coverage. If you have any questions about campfire recovery, you can submit them on our website, mynspr.org. For Thursday, February 21st, 2019, this is After Paradise. After tens of thousands fled the ridge from the campfire more than 3 months ago, it seems like Chico is bursting at the seams. There's more of pretty much everything. More people, more lines, more traffic, but there is no housing. Lack of housing was already a huge problem in Chico before the fire happened, with rental vacancy pre-campfire in the 1 to 2% range. Last week, a State of the City and Business Summit was held that pointed to this lack of housing as being key in predicting Chico's future. Today, we turn a large part of this program to Chico Mayor Randall Stone. He spoke at the summit and with North State Public Radio's Mark Albert about Chico's housing issue and what, if anything, the city can do to help solve it.
My background is in housing. What I've done for most of my life has been affordable housing, and housing affordability and municipal economics has been the focus of my master's studies. So this is, you know, a part and parcel of my field and my background. So it seemed appropriate that I should probably lead the city in its greatest housing crisis that it's ever seen. It was something that I was probably toying with anyway. We had 1,092 homeless people as of 2 years ago's count for homeless in the city of Chico. And that's just the city of Chico alone. So we know with the 10,000, 20,000 additional people coming down from Paradise, Concow, and Magalia that we have oversaturated all possible housing and even couches and alcoves and that type of emergency housing. We've exhausted all of those possibilities. So we need to be much more aggressive about our housing policy and our willingness to develop.
Now, so much of the focus of the media attention is on the tragedy and people who lost their homes. It's been where a lot of the energy and concern has been, people getting trailers, people finding a place to stay. But there are other cascading issues with housing. When someone who does have an insurance settlement purchases a house, or someone who owns a house sees an opportunity. And tell me about some of the cascading effects around Chico in terms of housing.
Well, there's just a limited supply. We have a real estate restriction, but in trying to find viable land that can be developed is a challenge. We have a very small number of developers that have land banked over the past few decades. That was a strategy that was probably helpful to keep out Lennar Homes and KB Homes.
And those are national production builders.
Yeah, they're not in the city of Chico. So our builders and developers are local folks that have lived here for a while, but they're artificially restricting supply of housing. And that's a business model. I'm not criticizing that.
And that's also a city decision with the Green Line, that the areas were reserved or made, you know, sort of taken off the table.
Well, sure. On our western edge, we have the Green Line, but that's the interesting details. The chamber's message was that there was environmental, agricultural, and city municipal regulatory reasons why we weren't building and developing housing, that we should be looking for special planning areas. Interestingly enough, the city has 5,300 current units, housing units. That's 2,500 housing units for single-family homes and 2,800 multifamily units. Those are the remaining permits through the city or regulatory authority is ministerial at this point, meaning they just have to pull a building permit. So there's some other reason why those homes are not being built that have something to do with the developer. And those have nothing to do with special planning areas. So in other words, these are projects that are just sitting and waiting for the developer to build them, that the city has already gone through its process and allowed that development to move forward.
So it's past the zoning, it's past the planning department, the permits were given, the project was approved, and it sits.
There's some other reason that is not having to do with the city's regulatory authority, and there are great reasons for that. I mean, if you're a developer and you're sensitive about what the market may be like, or you're not able to pull together the capital at the immediate moment that you may need, you know, there's a lot of different reasons why developers wouldn't build. But the law of large numbers will kind of tell you that 5,300 units are sitting and waiting to be built. These are 5,300 housing units. Those are individual households. Maybe one person in that household, if it's a one bedroom, one bath, but you know, three bedrooms, two baths, the entire run of those units. 2,500 homes, single family homes, and 2,800 apartments, multifamily units.
You're in the real estate business yourself. You finance some low-income housing, but you know, small-scale developments. Developers obviously need to time the market. They want to buy low and sell high, just like everyone else. With 10% of the dwelling units in the county no longer existing, there seems to be a great push and getting a premium price. Right now would seem to be a great time to be selling a home. Why are they sitting on these permits?
Well, again, I can't make any guesses as to why an individual developer would make that decision, but collectively with 5,300 units, you would expect that we would be moving forward. We also have no single FEMA trailer sites. So we have, in the city of Chico's city limits, that has not taken place yet. And we've gotten some calls from some officials that maybe we should or shouldn't be adding some homes here. I don't understand why there's even a shouldn't section of that. We should be appraising all possible options. But so far, what has been suggested is that we should be looking at special planning areas. I'd like to see us get those projects that already have engineering done, that already have plans done, that have already been submitted to the city, that are ready to go, and there's some other reason on the developer side that they're not moving forward with those projects. I mean, that's 5,000 housing units. If you've got 10,000 people, that's half the need that's just sitting and waiting in permits.
I think the city administration has really signaled that they're willing to upzone, or they're willing to move mountains or do whatever it takes. Has anyone come forward with any of these projects that have already been approved and look to add more units or reconfigure to have additional housing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the city has run down the fees for accessory dwelling units. Once $12,000 for on average for the development impact fees, then shifted down to $6,000, now down to $3,000, and in a lot of cases we can get some backfill subsidy for even those $3,000. So it's effectively free from an impact fee standpoint from the city of Chico. And accessory dwelling units are mother-in-law units. So these are kind of the sweet spot for housing for our need right now. They're one bedrooms and two bedrooms, which can be much more affordable than your three bedroom, two bath, you know, the standard $368,000 median household price for that type of unit.
Generally, those are developed piecemeal, one by one. You know, a property owner decides they're going to upgrade their garage, or they're going to build something on their own property. That's single units that are not necessarily going to be solving this larger issue.
Well, no, we're talking about a specific type of unit. The sweet spot, especially for our lowest income residents, are the ADUs, the one bedrooms and two bedrooms. And so that will help tremendously, as we've seen it in other communities that have had disasters like this as well. This is one of the tools that we have to get through this. On the other units, we need those single family and multifamily housing units as well. So we need every single housing type. We have executives that we're trying to recruit to the city of Chico because we have positions that are open, and we can't fill those positions because we don't have any housing for them, for any place for them to live. The same thing is true for employers throughout the city. So we need housing across the board. The economic expansion of existing businesses is curtailed by housing and housing affordability. The city government can't hire people for this disaster as well as for its regular operations because there's no housing. People have turned positions away, senior positions within the city, because they know that we can't provide housing for them within the city. So all of this is balled up into our tightest bottleneck is real estate. And that's why it's so important for property owners and developers to work with this community and respond to the need. We are in a federal disaster zone. And so whatever that means, whatever you think that looks like, we're in it right now. And if we've got 5,300 ready to go or relatively ready to go projects that are not waiting for the city, we need to get on those right away because they're already halfway through the process. We also, that doesn't mean that we still don't need special planning areas and additional housing, but 5,300 households, no matter how small or big that is, can be readily available pretty quickly. FEMA trailers can help with that. And we have land available that's ready to be developed, that's designed for these types of developments, before we even talk about special planning areas such as Tuscan Ridge or further up the hills.
So as somebody who has some experience in housing development, what's the lead time then if they're ready to go and the permits have been issued?
It's tough to say. I mean, I pulled a demo permit before in December and broken ground in January and been done with a 38-unit apartment complex by October. So that could give you some sense. But if there's some other hindrance that's causing them not to move forward, I can't forecast what that is. But yeah, I mean, these can definitely be moved much faster than a brand new project that's just starting with all of that that process.
Merriam Park, a project that is already under construction. Ken Grossman, who is involved with the Sierra Nevada Brewing Company and has been extremely generous to fire victims, have they considered any kind of reconfiguration or densifying that project?
Yeah, I'm not privy to the details, but Ken Grossman and Dan Gonzalez have been very responsive to every aspect of this disaster, and they're a strong partner with the city and the community. They're not one of those developers that isn't moving forward, at least in the phases that we would expect. So, as Mr. Francis mentioned at the event last Friday, you know, he notices that deposits are way up, and that would make sense for a banker. But that's precisely one of the things that concerns me the most, is that people are not building and then we're not moving forward with purchasing new homes. You know, I toured active fires in communities that were ravaged by fires within the city limits. So what I'm talking about is Weed. I toured the Weed fire with my fire chief at that time, as well as the Valley fires in Lake County. And I met an elected official out there that did one of those fires, who explained to me that he was very concerned about how to avoid becoming a community of fifth wheels. And what that means is when people get their insurance money, it sits in the bank, they're living on a fifth wheel waiting to replace their home, to rebuild, but they don't. And gradually money runs out and the realities of the gap between what you've received in insurance and what you can now rebuild at grows and grows. And then you become a community of people that are just in fifth wheels that are living on that property, and the property tax base declines and the economic base is destroyed. So that's kind of the reality, the concerns that we have moving forward.
People who are tenants, people who usually were renting homes or renting marginal quality construction, they're facing some issues.
You're touching on a subject that is pretty grotesque in everyday life and becomes that much more disastrous. When we had a less than 1% vacancy rate for multifamily housing on November 7th, so one day before the fire, what you see in those cases, rents spike ridiculously for people that are on the margins, people that may be here illegally, people that maybe have something in their history that is keeping them from renting at market rate, bad credit, what have you, disparate families. So people will overpay. And by that, I mean, you'll have a one bedroom, one bath kitchenette without a full kitchen or refrigerator renting for $900 a month. That was before the campfire. So people were being taken advantage of and exploited in this community before the campfire. Once you have such a disparity in housing supply versus demand, you see that exploitation grow even more. And these are people whose rights are taken away from them, that they're living in substandard housing that doesn't have appropriate plumbing. So code enforcement has to step forward and make sure that people are not being taken advantage of and exploited. And that's just a whole nother undercurrent of the types of things that we deal with in housing and housing affordability. You can't have people being exploited in this community. Eventually, when you live on the backs of poor people, eventually they do rise up. And so we've got to take care of these people.
That was Chico Mayor Randall Stone. You're listening to After Paradise, a special production from North State Public Radio. More just ahead. We'll be right back. This is After Paradise, a special program on the aftermath of the campfire from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Californians who live in an area devastated by wildfires have new protections as of January 1st. If their home survives a blaze, their property insurer must maintain their coverage for at least a year after the disaster. But as Capital Public Radio's Pauline Bartolone learned, the new law has come too late for those who are still reeling from the campfire.
Tamara and Tom Connery get a rush of emotion when they look at their old neighborhood in Paradise. It's an apocalyptic landscape of burned-up rubble, mixed in with a few vacant homes that survived.
So much of it doesn't make any sense. This house is here, this house is not.
The Connerys' home was barely touched by November's blaze. Fire officials say about 1 in 10 buildings in the town are still standing. And at first, the couple was dead set on returning.
So we'll go ahead and wipe the feet, but just know.
But as Tamara shows me the inside of their house, she explains they have their own steep climb to normalcy. The home is contaminated by ash and smoke, and their deck was scorched. Their homeowners insurer covered their temporary housing. But recently, Tamara got some bad news. The company, American Reliable, decided not to renew their policy.
Getting that letter just was like a slap in the face. Right now, when it's going to be the hardest time ever to get insurance at any kind of reasonable price, that's when you non-renew us.
The Connerys say trying to make their home livable again has been stressful enough, and finding new insurance has just added to that headache.
Sometimes I feel like it would have been easier if the house had burned down and then you're moving on.
Tom and Tamara are not the only ones with this problem. The state's Department of Insurance says they've heard from other Californians in fire areas who lost their insurance.
Their situation can almost be worse sometimes than people whose homes are gone.
Amy Bach with the consumer advocacy group United Policyholders says she knows people in this situation too. If your house burns down, California law says your policy must be renewed for at least 2 years. But that doesn't help the Connerys.
They're sort of competing with the total loss victims for attention and dollars, but they also don't have the same protection that a total loss victim has to keep their insurance.
American Reliable's parent company, Global Indemnity, didn't respond to multiple requests for comment for the story. But Mark Sanknin, a spokesperson for the property insurance industry, says companies have to always reassess their risks.
You want to make sure you don't have too many policies concentrated in a particular area, because then if there is a loss, it can have negative implications for the company.
One insurer already went belly up because of the campfire. But Sanknin says there are about 50 insurers in California, so homeowners in fire areas are likely to find another option. They should expect to pay more, though.
And that's to ensure that, you know, people in the high-risk areas should pay a higher amount for insurance than people who live in low-risk areas. Otherwise, people like where I live would end up subsidizing these people.
Watch your step on that.
The Connerys recently found a new homeowner's policy. A last resort plan California law provides for people like them. They're paying more than double what they did before. But the devastation in Paradise and the insurance headaches have been too much for the Connerys. They've recently decided they're not going back, and they've put their house up for sale. I'm Pauline Bartolone in Chico, California.
Who is going back to Paradise and who is not is still unclear at this point. And it's not a decision only those who lived in the town have to make, but also one that has to be made by those who owned businesses in the community and who worked there. While some businesses have reopened, the majority have not. North State Public Radio's Mark Albert spoke with Monica Nolan, the executive director of the Paradise Ridge Chamber of Commerce, to check in with Paradise's business community. The first thing he asked was how businesses on the Ridge are functioning right now.
Well, right now, the businesses that are up and running are able to address what we're calling the interim economy, serving the population that is left on the Ridge and also the interim workforce, the PG&E base camp, the debris clearers, and construction workers who are waiting with bated breath to get started. The businesses that are able to be open right now have a flexible business model. For instance, our local Save Mart is able to serve the workers with lunch and have pivoted their business model slightly to include some microwave stations and tables for people to sit inside and eat.
When you think about what services and what businesses make up a town and make something livable, it's been a slow process as electricity is being restored. What holes have been most visible?
It has to be the restaurants. We do have Red Lion Pizza up in Magalia, and like I said, the Save Mart Deli. But with a lack of water at this point, restaurants are having a difficult time opening.
There's a lot of area that was untouched by the fire, especially further up the ridge in Magalia. I assume those businesses are perhaps seeing an uptick in business just because there's less competition.
Yes, initially when folks like me who live on the upper ridge were able to get back home, we were heavily reliant on the gas stations and the food marts connected to them. Chuck's Place and Hill's Country Store, they were very crowded back in late November, early December.
But with so few residents on the ridge and being able to stay there, and now with the uncertainty regarding being able to live on your property during the debris removal phase, businesses must have a big problem deciding whether to reopen and, you know, how much staffing and how much inventory and how much activity will be needed and what would be profitable. It must be a tremendously difficult time for businesses.
It is, and they have to weigh those decisions carefully about whether they can weather this peculiar economy. The larger businesses like Save Mart, Wells Fargo, Starbucks have that corporate backing where they are able to be open and support the community and not necessarily make a huge profit. The smaller mom and pops, our recommendation would be to receive all the advice you can from all of the various agencies, such as the Small Business Development Center, SCORE, 3CORE, and start small. There are also workforce issues with many of those businesses having lost staff. And those businesses who are not opening yet, it may be because the business owner is suffering the dual loss of both home and business.
And then additionally, a lot of the employees maybe have been burned out and have been relocated to someplace so distant that it may not make financial sense for them to go back to work due to a commute. How helpful has the Small Business Administration been?
The Small Business Administration is in the business of loans. I don't believe that they are offering any grants. However, they have excellent terms on loans for qualifying businesses. And I would recommend anyone who hasn't to at least go ahead and fill out those forms. And the deadline is the 15th. The SBA has been extremely proactive in trying to put resources in the hands of our businesses. They have made 6,000 phone calls. And it's been very difficult to connect to our business community because we may only have a landline number for them.
Now, Monica, the Paradise Ridge Chamber of Commerce has come up with a website or a Facebook group to try to connect businesses and let residents know what's open and what's not and what's available.
Actually, there is a Facebook group called Paradise Businesses Reopened and Relocated. It was started by one of our town council members, and that's been an excellent resource with people posting their status. And then the chamber has tried to aggregate that data while chiefly relying on businesses to self-report through ParadiseChamber.com. There is a survey link, and we urge all businesses to self-report their status. That is the way we will get the best information and be able to give the businesses both visibility and connect them to the resources that they may need.
I understand the Paradise Ridge Chamber of Commerce has also established a business for business Facebook page or Facebook group. What is that and how is that helpful to residents and business owners?
The Business for Business Facebook group was in response to the welcome challenge that we experienced of too much benevolence almost. So we wanted, rather than to have our staff drive all over the state picking up furniture and supplies that people were offering, we wanted to connect those businesses directly with donors. So the Business for Business Facebook page is for campfire-affected businesses to connect with donors who want to give them material things and other resources. And that can be accessed through the Paradise Ridge Chamber of Commerce Facebook page.
I also understand that the Paradise Ridge Chamber of Commerce has waived its membership fees.
The Paradise Ridge Chamber of Commerce welcomes all Ridge businesses who have been affected by the fire to join and pay if and what they can.
The city and other officials have been speculating, wondering how many residents are going to move back. How many people will stick it out after the delays and this constantly changing timeline for being able to return and rebuild? What does it look like from the business community? Obviously, one can't move forward and make a tremendous investment with so much uncertainty.
Yes, that is exactly the landscape we're looking at, is one of uncertainty at this point. And also, it's a chicken and egg problem. Do the residents come first and draw the businesses, or do the businesses come first and draw the residents? But at this interim stage right now, when essentially there is no rebuilding happening because we're only commencing phase two of debris removal, it's very difficult to say. But there is support for businesses who want to open. PID recently stated that Cal OES and FEMA will supply water tanks to businesses as we wait for the water situation to get sorted out.
Are you thinking more in the interim or in the long term about attracting businesses back, or is this way too early and we're just barely out of the gate?
I think that that is going to come along with city planning. We're going to be commencing some preliminary stages of city planning, and going along with those conversations, it needs to be what needs to be addressed is the type of industry we may want to attract to the Ridge. In the past, the biggest employers were the school district and the hospital. But we may want to look at some other models with all of the talent we are attracting from around the globe with this blank slate that is the Paradise Ridge at the moment. I would like to see some of that talent include economic development.
Monica Nolan, Executive Director of the Paradise Ridge Chamber of Commerce, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
We have come to the end of our program, but before we go, a few important announcements. The first meeting of the official Town of Paradise rebuilding scoping process is scheduled for tomorrow. It will be at the Paradise Alliance Church at 10 in the morning. The church is located at 6491 Clark Road. Along the same vein, but fleshed out with some concepts, schematics, and design, a group of 36 students from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo's architectural program, who have been reimagining the rebuild of Paradise, will also be presenting tomorrow. That forum will also be at 10 in the morning. It will run until noon and will be on Chico State's campus in Landon Hall 200. And next Thursday, February 28th, is the deadline for property owners to sign up for the Alternative Debris Removal Program. This debris removal option entails hiring a properly licensed contractor and submitting a work plan to the county. According to the county, they have received 372 alternative program applications. For more information, visit buttecountyrecovers.org. And that's our program for Thursday, February 21st, 2019. After Paradise is produced by Mark Albert, Phil Wilkie, and Tess Vigland. Adam Raguzia composed our theme music. Our engineer is Matt Fidler. Special thanks to Capital Public Radio and KQED. And don't forget, we want to hear your questions. Some of you wanted to know how long the disaster recovery centers will remain open. According to Butte County Public Information Officer Casey Hatcher, the two currently open locations in Chico and in Paradise will both close on March 1st. If you have a question, you can submit it at mynspr.org. Thank you for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, and this is After Paradise from North State Public Radio.